This episode is brought to you in part by Fireside Folk Tales. We'll hear more from them later on the show. Hello there. My name is Doc Conrad, and this is my little preamble to the podcast. First of all, I want to go ahead and say thank you to all the wonderful artists and guests who have come onto this podcast. I really do appreciate it. At Meloscav, at M-E-L-O-S-C-A-V, is the one who created the icon for this podcast. And at Doidaflower, at D-O-I-D-U-H-F-L-O-W-E-R, is the artist behind the visuals on YouTube and other social media sites. At Andromeda underscore Snow is the artist who has made all the promotional material for this podcast as well that you see when guests are revealed. Also, if you're finding this podcast on your own, if you'd like to give up the show, we are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, and Newgrounds at Comms Open Podcast. Today's guest is the absolutely wonderful Dallas Wheatley, a non-binary voice actor, podcaster, director, and online business owner, and honestly is one of my favorite interviews so far, and it's all comes down to one single moment at towards the very end, so be sure to stay tuned. You can follow Dallas right now at Sweet Podcast, but it's spelled S-W-H-E-A-T Podcasts on Twitter. Either way, I don't want to take up too much of your time before we get into this episode. So, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Commissions Open, an interview podcast all about art in the digital age. Here you can hear the processes, stories, and lives of artists, voice actors, video creators, editors, musicians, and many other talented creators in the era of online work. I am your host, Doc Conrad, and today I am joined by the absolutely wonderful Dallas Wheatley. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. How do you want to go ahead and start this? You want to go ahead and start with, like, the work that you've done in, well, I'll give you a little bit of a summary. You are a voice actor. You have done directing work. Yes. You are a podcaster, and you even make soap as well.
Yes.
More of like a hobby you mentioned, but it's definitely like a thing you've done, and you've done things all across like the internet and everything along that. But let's go ahead and talk about your voice acting, because I know that was one, you said that was one of the things you first started out with. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when I started off with voice acting, I was living in Maine, in the capital city of Maine, so Augusta, Maine. Mm-hmm. Working in a job that wasn't paying me enough, and just trying to figure out a way to get through the winters. And I was having trouble with theater because depression is hard. And sometimes you just can't bring yourself to put on pants and go to rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And that got really rough in Maine. And I started listening to a lot more podcasts. I started listening to a lot more audio drama specifically. Because they gave me a way to feel a bit more immersed in, like, the theater culture. Mm-hmm. And I finally started auditioning for audio dramas with my computer microphone. Suffice it to say, I did not get any parts with that crappy little microphone. And when I started working with my D&D group to do a little podcast called Dice Fiends, I got a mic for like $20. I started doing some more auditions. I started looking at videos of like how to insulate your space, you know, putting up egg cartons on the walls and like slinging mattresses up against walls and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And then I think finally with Windfall, with the release of Windfall, I don't know if you know what Windfall is. Windfall is a sci-fi audio drama. Mm-hmm. Written by the Raimonda brothers, and they needed a bit part actor for one episode in the background. I sent in the lines within like the hour, and ever since then I've just been like doing more and more auditions. I've been writing my own stuff. I did the Nuclear Solution as my first sort of experimental show. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on Fireside Folktales now, which is an anthology show. Writing another script about Robin Hood, and I can't really say much about that, but
Gotta keep things hush. I understand. So you have done mostly voice acting work inside the audio drama space. You said
yes.
And a lot of that has been like you've done stuff with White Vault as well. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I'm staring at the scripts in front of me right now. They're making me feel guilty because I haven't finished them yet. but it's for their mini series Iluka, which is about a research vessel off the coast of Iceland, and from their Tales from the Tower Liberty miniseries, which is going up on Patreon soon, I think. So mm-hmm. I started joining with the White Vault in that, which I'm still going a little crazy over. I'm going to be honest here. The White Vault is like this big, in terms of how indie drama that is, and I'm sure people will disagree with me, but you know, whatever. In terms of indie drama, White Vault kind of feels like a bigger name. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a more recognized, like, I guess you could call it, like, a household name in terms of indie audio drama. So I got approached to do something for the White Vault team, and I lost my mind. I was like, I agreed, of course, and then I was like, they're probably going to forget about that. And then 4 months later, they DM'd me again, and they were like, hey, so this is the year. We're going to be doing it. and they sent me scripts, and I've been recording scripts and sending them files, and it's kind of crazy, and I don't think I'm going to think it's real until I actually hear it in my phone.
yeah, there's a lot of, like, lost amount of... there's a lot of surreal things that you realize that, like, just because of how small of a voice actor or voice actress, like, people are, like, once it finally, like, comes out, there's, like, a coming to, like, realization moment, like, oh, everything I've been doing has been real.
Yeah, that's, I think it's interesting, too, especially working, you know, kind of from your closet, rather than going to a studio to record a bunch of stuff. So much less of the process feels tangible and rewarding. You know, I could do this in my pajamas. I have done this in my pajamas. And I'm wearing sweatpants right now. So, like, I guess, at least that's how I see it, is, like, so much less of the process with voice acting in your closet. Like, it's great because I can stay home and do it. But there aren't any of those intervals that you have that sort of click into your brain to say, hey, you did a thing.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a little difficult for, like, that sort of thing to be become realized. But still, like, there is there's a lot to go ahead and say about it, not to say that it's, like, easy, but it's a lot more voice acting and doing work for all these different things has got to be, like, some very stressful work, because you realize you're making work from this sort of thing, and you have, of course, there's, like, the imposter syndrome that everybody has. I have so far not met an independent voice actor or voice actress or whatever, or even, like, anybody who has not felt, like, imposter syndrome once they get, like, recognized by a wider audience.
Yep.
It is one of the biggest things to go ahead and feel. But I'm guessing that's why you've also, like, not specifically because of that. But I'm guessing that there's a quite a bit of a reason to, like, wanting to make something. And you have made, like, a number of different podcasts as well, despite you working on your own voice acting work.
Yes.
And you mentioned The Nuclear Solution. Why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about that?
Okay. So The Nuclear Solution, I describe it as my concussed fever dream that came to me one day. I was getting really frustrated, getting my foot in the door with, like, indie shows with voice acting. I didn't have my sound quality quite where I wanted it to be. I didn't really have any experience working with a microphone at all. So I wasn't, you know, aware of, if I don't have a pop filter, maybe I should think about, you know, how I'm delivering certain words. And with The Nuclear Solution, I slipped in the shower one morning, got a concussion because I hit my head against the door, and I was working, took the whole week off from work, and I was at home. It wasn't a concussion bad enough that, you know, I couldn't move. You know, I could look at the computer, and I got really bored looking at my phone all day. And I just started writing. And I wrote a kind of fun little script, and then I started turning it into a show after I had only one script written. And that experience taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about translating, you know, stage delivery to microphone delivery. It taught me a lot about what goes into sound editing and how to sort of put that into script terms and how to translate ideas into sounds, because I'm not a sound designer and I gave myself a lot of work with that show. There are a lot of sound effects in that show that I do not translate, that I'm not proud of, and that at some point I had been working on it all day and I just said, it's good enough. And I put it down. And that's kind of really what that show stands for me, is it really helped kickstart me into voice acting because it gave me something to work with when I asked people if I could audition for their show. You know, I had a name written down on a piece of paper. I had some clips of audio of me having read from scripts before with, like, different emotional tensions and everything. And I really appreciate the Nuclear Solution for that. Yeah. I did not plan the ending to the show when I started writing it, however, and I don't recommend that for people.
That's a big part of, like, learning the whole learning process, and that being your first show, like, it's still like a lot of it is a major amount of learning experience, and I'm guessing it's like goes beyond the traditional sense of learning the skills that you did going from, like, learning traditionally with, like, in a classroom from a teacher standpoint. A setting is a lot different than making something, realizing the mistakes that as you make it, comparing yourself to those sort of things, but recognizing that it wasn't because, like, oh, I'm awful. It's because you don't have enough experience yet, so you use that as a learning tool. And I'm guessing that's how you felt during that, with, like, everything you know you knew how to do, everything you, like, had some sort of, like, recognizing a talented ability to do, and some things you, like, realize, like, need a lot more work.
Yeah, and I actually think it's kind of a double-edged experience as well, because I think it's made me a better director and a better writer and even a better actor to know all of the components that go into making an audio performance. But I don't think that it's people should have to do all of those things to themselves in order to make a good show. And that's kind of where Fireside Folktales came into play, was I saw how much work and how much emotional investment and how much mental and even, like, physical investment at times went into just trying to put yourself into something. And the audio dramas are super complicated. You know, you do an interview show, you know how much work goes into creating audio files for people.
Exactly.
And it's just not something that everybody has the ability or the will for. You know, there are tons of great writers out there who don't have the skills or don't have the accessibility to create their own audio files. And there are a lot of great sound designers out there who don't want to write their own script and don't want to act in their own script as well. We hire out voice actors to do all of these 600 other voices that we put in our scripts so that we don't have to do them ourselves. And I wanted to give that chance to writers and sound designers too. So that's how Fireside Folktales came into being.
And I definitely think that the first one gave you a lot of perspective and not only, like, what you needed. And I know you say that, like, it's not something that is required to go ahead and make a good show. Of course it's not. There's a lot of good shows that have a lot of different people on different teams. But I definitely think it helped you on the directing sort of sense, because you were able to go ahead and, like, delegate work, know what exactly sort of work has been done, what work needs to, like, be segmented out to different people. If you do that all on your own in the beginning from the work that you have started with, you're able to go ahead and recognize, like, oh, it's this person's job to do this and this alone, and I won't go ahead and overload, like, an intern with, like, 12 things because I was there. Whereas some people have sort of gone into the more of the corporatized mindset of, like, we'll just make that. And then, like, they have to go ahead and, like, have to wear a ton of different hats for, like, a major production show. And I think that that sort of, like, the independent sort of thing has definitely helped you out in the directing wise. And I think it helps out nearly everyone who goes through that. If you want to go ahead and learn how to be a director, putting your feet to fire is definitely a solid way to learn, like, all the different bits that that are required in order to get into everything.
You learn a lot really fast.
Yeah. But why don't we talk more about exactly what Fireside Folktales is? It's currently in production at the time of recording, and it's coming out in May 2020. I don't know if exactly like the timeline's going to be going working out like April. Yeah, it's going to be past May when this episode comes out. So the episode will come out at this point. But why don't you go ahead and talk a bit about it?
Okay. Yes. So first things first about Fireside Folktales. The first season of the show is called Whispering. It's a queer adapted Greek myth turned into a single season of an audio drama. So there are a lot of mythology shows that are doing great storytelling, and they're usually done in a narrative sense, where they kind of walk you through what the myth is, and this is me taking the myth, tearing it to pieces, and piecing it back together like a little scrapbook.
Mm-hmm.
In the gayest way possible. It's so gay. Mm-hmm. I love it. But the sound designer for that show, her name is Emily Parrish, and she is actually a college student right now. So as colleges are closing up, I've had to put the production for Whispering on temporary hold until she gets resettled back at home.
Yeah.
And like through the stress of all the, literally being kicked out of school. So I don't know if the release is still going to be May or not. It's looking more like June or July.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a heads up.
Oh no, that's fine, and definitely like there is of course like a lot of things are changing, shifting right now. And I don't want to make this like a current events like portion of the podcast, because like this is of course like, but it's part of what has affected a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. And so like there is of course like some things to go ahead and be mentioned there. What I like is the idea of I think that the idea of making it more related to queer people is one of the best things ever, because not only is it a better representation of things that are like going on in our current like world, and it people need to hear these stories from a different perspective, but it also works in the folktale sense of it shaping to different of it like shaping to different ways, and
And that's kind of how I've been looking at it, is, queerness is eternal, queerness is ancient, and queerness has evolved with humans and with other species on Earth. And they've also shaped a lot of these stories when you look back into, so a lot of my influence for this particular story came from ancient Minoan pottery.
Mm-hmm.
And the original Persephone and Hades story is about a big, scary, grim reaper kind of guy breaks open the earth underneath Persephone and kidnaps her and takes her away and force feeds her like pomegranate seeds to get her to stay in the underworld with him forever. And, Zeus is this big, mighty hero man who swoops down and saves her. And I hate it so much. I hate the framing of that story, but it's a story that's stuck with me since I was a kid, and I'm not entirely sure why. And when I was going through all of this old sculpture and all this old pottery and kind of frescoes and stuff like that, and going through all of the like archaeological analyses of them, there was a lot of mention of the two maidens of spring, which could be interpreted as Demeter and Persephone. Called Demeter and Kore, Demeter and the Maiden. And a lot of interpretations of Persephone herself being somebody who was, instead of being kidnapped, was somebody who essentially became a harbinger of change, in that she stepped foot across into the underworld herself as a way to become as the transition, as the seasonal change, as the retribution, because there are a bunch of different translations of Persephone online. I didn't study ancient Greek. My friend Whitney knows a lot better about this. So take everything I say coming up next with a grain of salt. But allegedly, according to the stuff that I remember, Persephone translates something like to the chaos bringer. And so when you put together those two concepts of like the maiden of transitions and the chaos bringer, you get the sense that, Persephone had a lot more agency than originally thought. And when you look at the old interpretations of all the Greek gods as well, you see a lot more agency in their actions in relation to different genders and different sexualities and different, like, relationships with each other. So Athena supposedly, according to one myth, had a romantic love for a woman who died, and she never took another lover.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even said that she took a lover in this sense, but that she did feel the love for this woman. So instead of Athena being, you know, asexual or a virgin, you know, perhaps she was asexual and she still loved a woman. It's not mm-hmm. that she was, like, anti-men. It's that she had a completely different sexuality. Mm-hmm. And you see this get wrapped up in things like Ovid that I read in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Ovid's Metamorphoses. I don't know if you've read it. And you see it in all these different books. So you could read, like, Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology and Greek mythology. You could read Dolaire's Greek myths. And there are so many writings about Greek myths. And you see the way that they just keep getting twisted and twisted and twisted over each rendition. Even with the oldest scholars back in ancient Greece, using different choice words to describe people in negative or positive lights in order to make it suit what they think is the right way to tell that story and what they think is, like, the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
And all these stories are so complex to begin with in terms of human nature and how it relates to all the things we don't understand about ourselves and about the earth and about queerness itself.
Yeah. And of course, I don't want to go ahead and be the one to go ahead and, like, state, like, this is what your podcast. No, I'm not going to go ahead and do that.
No.
But what I do think is very interesting, especially in the folktale sense, is that throughout the entirety of human history, folktales have been a sense of telling a story with a moral, like, end at the end of it. Like, this is the way you should feel about these things, whether it be faith-based, like in what they believe to be reality, or now mythologically based and now realizing that it is more of a story that is can be recognized. Even some of like different faiths today, a lot of it has those sort of, like, the general idea of anything, like, faith-based initially and then told throughout, whether it be a story or something like that, is to have a moral, is to be a moral, not only a telling, but a reflection of the climate that has been set today. And I think what you're doing is providing a new sort of, like, light and shining context on the sort of thing of, like, these different stories have, like, not only are they historically accurate to the tales that have been told, but brought into a different way or taught or like spoken in a different light or anything along those lines, like the ability to go ahead and not to erase the old stories because they've been told thousands upon thousands of times, but to spin it in a way that is shown on the side for a new light of people to go ahead and realize that, like, there are a lot of stories that are involved with queer people that have been in here that have just not been either shown or changed because of the reflection of the climate that happened previously, or maybe things have changed beforehand, or maybe they should be changed to reflect the people that are here today. And I think that is there's a wonderful sort of like same sort of mirroring that you see that you are providing to the world today. And I think that's what Fireside Folktales is going to be great.
Thank you so much. And that's actually, that was another piece that went into it, was I felt like a lot of shows were unpacking all of our old folktales and myths, and nobody was really, you know, redoing them the way mm-hmm. that we have been doing for centuries and millennia existing mm-hmm. as a species on this earth. Like, they've existed for so long for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we should be doing honor to that by helping them keep living.
Yeah, there is a case to be said that, like, quote unquote historical accuracy should always be, like, a thing that you should strive for, and that may be the case. But things have been changing all these times, whether it be from these different cultures to translate them better into different sort of ways, or hearing about it in these sort of different ways. Perhaps people initially thought, like, oh, that's just how it happened. Like, they didn't go ahead and look at it further from the perspective of the story. Teller saying the things is absolute truth, or like the story is exactly how it was when it happened. But this is a But that's the point of a folktale and a myth, to reflect not only the lessons that you can learn now, but to be a reflection of the world as it is like today, and talking about it, and like to recognize like, oh, this is somewhat parallel to this in my life, or yes, this sort of thing. And I think that being able to change it is actually pardon me, it's actually a bit more accurate to the intention of what a folktale really is by shifting it to something more direct. And of course, it's not as quote-unquote accurate as the initial tellings are, but every single telling of it has never been 100% accurate to whatever sort of thing is, and that's the point of a folktale in the first place.
And that's why they're called a folktale, is because mm-hmm. it's the stories of the folks, of the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a reflection of that. That's more of like my sort of two cents on it. I don't know. Yeah. I'm guessing there's like a lot more that you've been thinking about involved with it.
Oh my goodness, yes. I could speak for hours, and I think I've already taken one long breathless chunk out in this interview to talk about it. But I do want to mention that Fireside Folktales, it is so many things. It's more than just an anthology. It's also what I'm hoping will become a space for independent authors to submit their scripts for development, essentially, for production, so that they don't have to worry about, you know, also being the sound designer and the actor and the marketer and all that stuff. And, you know, I'll be the contact. I'll find them a sound designer. I'll find them people to work with. I'll offer to help direct. I could even run casting, and then it would be an opportunity for me to give space to voices of people whose stories might be going lost or being unheard. So, like I said, queer people with whispering, but also indigenous folks and African stories from like West Africa or East Africa, or Southeast Asian stories, and, you know, give those people a space because they may not have it.
Allow me to give you a scenario. You're with your boys about to go to the Ren Fair. You decide to bring your Monster Energy Zero Ultra 24 fluid ounce can with you. You then realize the Ren Fair won't allow you to bring in outside drinks. Uh-oh. What do you do? Well, the only logical thing, of course. You chug that sucker like you've never seen the bottom of a can before. You've never had to go to the bathroom more in your life.
Welcome to the middle bit. The entirety of this middle bit will be dedicated to one thing and one thing only. Fireside Folktales by Dallas Wheatley. You just heard the full description of what it is, so I'm going to cut straight into it. This is the first trailer for Fireside Folktales.
Stories, myths, legends. What are they really? Fictional tales justifying the unknown world around us? Personifications of unexplainable phenomenon? Perhaps. But stories all come from somewhere, don't they? They change over time with each new telling. They evolve with us as we learn and grow. But so much can be lost in the process. The people in power set the rules and the stories follow suit. The original messages can be lost through time as toxic attitudes and cultures twist your stories to suit their needs. No longer. My name is Hestia. I am the keeper of the flame and the hearth, the storyteller of the gods. And I am here to bring these stories, these myths, back to life, in the way they always ought to have been. Please, join me around the fire, won't you? It's time to hear the tale of a lost young immortal searching for her purpose and place in the world. This is the story of Kore. Fireside Folk Tales is a new, collaborative show that takes myths and legends from around the world and breathes life back into them, transforming them into single-season audio fiction performances. Each story is created by a different writer. The first season is the story of Kore and the Thonic gods of the Greek underworld, written by Dallas Wheatley. Do you have a story that you want to tell? Get in touch with us. We're looking for stories from all over the world, especially myths from regions such as Africa, South Asia, Scandinavia, Russia, South America, and more. Fireside Folk Tales is here to help you tell your story, and to make mythology queer again. Follow us at fireside_folk on Twitter for more information about the show. There's always a seat for you beside the hearth.
No, I definitely think that that is the beauty of of having this sort of general season telling a story and being able to go ahead and like make it sort of evergreen, because stories have been having the chance to stories are always being told, stories are always being made, and I definitely think that you putting yourself out there with this sort of platform to elevate further to different script writers or different voice actors or actresses is really an amazing thing that I wish to go ahead and do eventually. Being able to build, there's nothing more satisfying than being able to be open to building people up and helping them out with their sort of thing. And it's eventually what I want to go ahead and do with this podcast, is make people turn their light towards turn their head towards these different things, towards these different projects or artists or voice actors or podcasts. Yeah. And I definitely can see that is something similar that we're both trying to do. However, you are more in the storytelling wise, and I'm more of the direct take a look, and that's pretty much it.
Right. Well, I've just one day I realized that yes, I am non-binary, mm-hmm. And yes, sometimes I struggle with my family, but as far as things go, I've been insanely lucky. I have a stable day job. I have a closet that I can put my computer in. I could afford a microphone. I have a car. Mm-hmm. And still have time to make things that make me happy. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't be taking up space on the airwaves to preach about my ideas and my opinions when, I'm obviously not the one that matters here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe is that this is the right way to take it, at least for the time being, with my current resources. So
I can definitely attest to that. There's a lot of things that I've realized personally that I've been incredibly lucky to do, but my the main goal of everything is to recognize first off the most important person in every single person's life is themselves, and then from that point it is the ability to go ahead and take that energy that you have to make sure that you're okay enough to go ahead and
yes.
be able to move on, and then give to everybody else who can't or maybe has issues with the ability to, or is struggling in different ways. There is a lot to go ahead and be said there of wanting to move, wanting to take what you have, the privileges that you're able to go and have, and there's options of either being able to sulk about that and realize oh, I have this great thing and I'm wasting it, or you can turn it around and realize that because the opportunities that you've been given, giving it back to other people is a great thing to go ahead and do. That rant being said on my end, what I want to go ahead and talk about more is you, because you are an amazing podcaster and voice actor.
Oh my goodness.
And all that sort of work. I want to go ahead and talk a bit more about your other projects that you've been working on independently. That little tidbit we threw in there just a little bit, the soap opera, and Shire Suds.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So my babies, my pet projects, the ones that I'm sure I have maybe like 10 followers for.
Mm-hmm.
They love it to death, but there's only 10 of them, and that's okay. Oh, I feel bad, actually, because I haven't made an episode in maybe about 2 months now. I need to do that again. And now I have all the time in the world.
Okay.
The soap opera. So I'm a firm believer in joy.
Mm.
And that sounds kind of corny when I say it out loud. But I am. I'm a firm believer in joy. We are in some really rough and terrible times right now. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends who are angry. I am also very angry. We're all very tired.
Mm-hmm.
We're all pushing ourselves to the limit to find some reason to keep fighting. And for me, that answer is joy. Yes, it's therapeutic and it's wonderful and it's lovely to process trauma through your art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful and it's lovely to see your own trauma reflected in the art that you consume. But if that's the only art that exists, it stops being reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts being... what's the word? Not like compressive, but it starts feeling oppressive, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You start to feel like you're suffocating a bit. Mm-hmm. Because it feels like the only thing that exists anymore is trauma and is hurt and is pain and exhaustion mm-hmm. and fatigue and tired.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bring joy back. And I remembered that during some of my worst times in my life, the ways that I would just get through the day would be coming home from work and putting on The Joy of Painting with Bob Ross.
Mm.
I wouldn't even necessarily watch it. I would just put it on. He was such a calming and soothing presence. He had a smooth and buttery voice that felt like a warm hug on a cool fall day. He talked to you about the beauty of nature and the difficulties of life and how to keep moving forward and how to just paint what you like and do what you like, and if nobody's around, nobody's gonna judge you.
Mm.
I'm not a painter. I make soap. And I got kind of bored just making the same kinds of soap over and over again. And all of my friends know that I love to talk about soap, and I will talk about soap for hours.
Mm-hmm.
So to stop texting them about soap all the time, I decided to kind of funnel that. I wasn't sure why I thought I was the right person to be doing it, but it was just kind of a fun project. I had an idea. I was like, Bob Ross for soap! And that sort of became an idea. I had to figure out how to translate that into audio, because you just get a lot of immersion noise
mm-hmm.
happening, like immersion blenders just over. It's a lot of the audio is just that sound. But I sat down and I put some work into it, and I made the first episode. I talked about tools and ingredients. I realized how much stuff goes into making soap and gained a new appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a couple episodes and I sent them to some friends. They told me that they were really soothing, and I just thought, what the heck? It's not going to hurt mm-hmm. anybody to have these out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I make one person feel like they can get through the rest of the day, then that's good enough for me.
There's definitely something to be said about that. I'm gonna take a little bit what you said, like break it piece by piece. There's of course the first bit where you say that there's a lot of like worried about joy in the art that's reflecting, and I totally can go ahead and see that. A lot of especially like drawn art and vent art can be very, like you said, very therapeutic in terms of like being able to recognize it and put it out there and reflect it back. But you're to your point, like I also agree that like there is always going to need to be something to break up the monotony of no matter what it is, whether it always you can you always need to have something that can like break up what you exactly you've always been doing and having a consistent like breakthrough of it, especially if things are turning either stale or not working out as well. The joy being like a thing that you've used to like cut through that sort of noise of like consistently looking at different things that are bad and that are like gone wrong, and being able to take a break from it is very like helpful in that regard. And you making it about something that is involved within your passion, I'm guessing not only has been like self, has been like a very, it's something that you know, and I know you're saying like, oh, I don't know if I'm the person for this. Of course you're the person for this. You not only make soap, you've made it for a while. You're passionate about it. You know the process through it. You know how to make a podcast. Like, if there was anybody who would make a soap podcast, it would be you. Like, that is that is the way you should go ahead and think about it. Is like, you have the talent to go ahead and make the product. You have the ability to go ahead and recognize like the way to get everything like through, making it further, and there's just, yeah, and I definitely agree with you that like wanting to go ahead and make some sort of and wanting to make the how do I put this, wanting to make a sort of thing for the specific point of like joy is a bit difficult when you're not able to go ahead and theme it around something. And I definitely think that finding that sort of niche of like people who enjoy the idea of soap making, it's something that like is definitely like it's definitely like needed in the sort of space. Like everybody's niche needs to be filled in this sort of thing, and finding a podcast like is like that is going to make a lot of make like not a whole lot of people tune in, but the people who do tune in find it to be the perfect thing that they would need.
Yeah, and also just, this is something I noticed with Bob Ross, is like, I love watching Bob Ross. I have never once set up a canvas and done one of his videos. Like, I've never painted with Bob Ross. I think it could be fun someday, but oil paints are really expensive, and the experience of watching him paint is enough for me. Mm-hmm. And I figure, maybe, you know, why not that with soap? Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot of people who would probably listen to my show and then actually make soap along with it. I think I have two listeners who do that. Mm-hmm. Most of the others just kind of listen to it because it makes them feel good. Mm-hmm. And that itself is way more than enough. The people who make soap along with me are like my superheroes, though. I can't believe it. They actually like made. I have a patron for my soap opera show. A single patron that supports me once a month and makes soap along with me and is getting a custom soap recipe from me because they're a patron for me, and that's incredible. And yeah, that means it's worth it for me. That means it's working. Mm-hmm.
And not only are you making these soaps just for the audio podcast, but you also sell them from Shire Suds. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. Shire Suds, I started, how many years ago is it now? I was in graduate school, so probably 3 or 4 years ago.
The Twitter says joined May 2018. I don't know if that helps, but...
Yeah, I think I started my Twitter maybe a year after I started selling soap, so...
Okay.
2017. Or maybe it was 2016. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It doesn't matter. I started making soap in grad school. And there's a whole long story surrounding why I started making it that I will not bore you with. There's a lot of grad school trauma involved. But I started making soap for people who have really sensitive skin or really dry skin. And I don't know if you've ever showered before. Hopefully you have. But when you shower and you're washing yourself, if you've used soap or body wash and you dry off, if your skin feels kind of tight and like it's a little dry, a little stretched out, that's because the soap that you're using dries out your skin too much. And I was having that issue a lot. My whole family has really dry skin. Mm-hmm. My soap, when you use it in the shower, doesn't do that. It leaves your skin feeling nice and moisturized. And I really like that. I also really focus on keeping the stock small and working with, you know, people who have particular skin allergies. So one of my friends from grad school is allergic to coconut. And most skincare products have coconut in it. coconut oil or, you know, a coconut-based surfactant or something like that. Surfactant, like a detergent.
Mm-hmm.
And so she couldn't use any of them. She basically, like, couldn't use any soap that she could get at the store. And that's kind of also how my company got started was, well, why is everybody using coconut oil in their soap? And I figured out alternatives, and I worked on getting the formula just right so that it was still moisturizing and cleansing and yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
And just started selling at farmers markets. Started selling at arts festivals. Started selling online, although that's been a little bit of a trudge because Etsy is not great when it comes to super small businesses, like one-person businesses. Mm. But I'm slowly gaining traction. I started making dice that look like D20s.
Yes.
And they're on a rope. I call it D-Soapy, so it's D-Soapy on a ropey. The Etsy CEO doesn't, SEO doesn't like that, though, so if I put that as a title, it won't show up in search engines, which is really upsetting, because I'm so proud of it. but I was on a panel about making game-themed products at PAX Unplugged back mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania in November, December-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you know, people have been getting interested in my soaps. People have been using them. I've been getting more reviews, which is great. And all of them have been 5 stars and amazing because my soaps are amazing, if I do say so myself.
That I'm glad that you're like confident in your work. That it's that I must say no. There are quite a number of people who continue to be like, oh, I don't know about like I just make it, and like you being confident in your work is a breath of fresh air, and I enjoy that so much because like there is I definitely think that like having some sort of like I've never really interviewed somebody who has made like physical products to be used. A lot of them make it like physical prints of arts or different mm-hmm. sort of things. But I'd love to go ahead and like I'm gonna go ahead and talk a little bit more about your personal life if you want to go ahead and talk about that. But I also want to talk about but before that I want to talk about the business aspect of like selling a product versus what you've worked on from like the voice acting and podcasting mm-hmm. standpoint. Like
okay. Yeah, so business with physical products is muy complicated. I don't know why I said that in Spanish. it's very complicated. It's way more complicated than you think it is kind of complicated. Even more so than podcasts, which are also more complicated than you think they are.
Mm-hmm.
Physical products, oh my goodness. You need to, in order to even set a base price for a bar of soap, you need to understand how much everything costs for you to make, modify, cut, whatever you need to do, and also pack and ship a single instance of that product, so like a single bar of soap.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves so many spreadsheets. Oodles of spreadsheets. I think I've lost half those spreadsheets in the time since I started my business because there were just so many of them. Coming down to how much does it cost to get these puffy envelope mailers that I can shove my soap into to ship them? How much does all the shipping labels cost? And then you can start to figure out, wow, I need to be charging $15 for a bar of soap, not $5.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a big thing. A lot of people underprice themselves because, like I said, Etsy's terrible and they list the cheapest stuff at the top.
Yeah.
So you see, like, a $1 bar of soap. Why buy a $15 one?
Mm-hmm.
And then compare that to voice acting, which, at least on my end, again, requires a lot of organization. I know a lot of people who do excellent voice acting and who are successful in audio drama without a voice reel. You don't really need one for audio dramas. I have one kind of just in case. But a lot of it is auditioning and auditioning and auditioning and networking, which is my least favorite word on the planet. so much networking. Most of my auditions have either been requested through networking or have just been, like, skipped over entirely because, you know, I knew somebody from another show who was working with somebody else on the second show, and they asked me if I wanted to do these lines for, you know, this unnamed character they have for episode 6.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of that. And there is some of that with selling physical items. So with Shire Suds, there is a bit of networking of me going around and being like, oh, hey, did you, you know, here's a free bar of soap. Running giveaways on Twitter every month to get people interested in your product. There's a lot more discussion about the physical aspects on the PAX Unplugged panel recording that we did. I think that's published on the soap opera. So I won't try to, like, come to your podcast talking about, like, how much shipping costs internationally.
Yeah.
But with the voice acting, you know, that's obviously a lot easier. It's electronic. It's good to have a backup of your stuff. It's good to be organized by, you know, show you're recording for. So I have about 17 different layers of folders on my computer for all my audio files. Don't know what I'll do if they ever go away. But that's most of it, I think. I think voice acting in terms of, not advertising, but marketing yourself for voice acting, most of it's networking.
Yeah.
My partner is Josh Rubino. I'm not sure how much you know about him, but in the indie community, he was on Caravan, he was on Windfall, he was Lord Baal on Caravan, and Captain Root on Windfall, and he's Liam Alden on Valence, which just came out. And that is 95% of how he gets his voice acting roles, is networking. Which is unfortunate when you hear it and you're just starting out, because I didn't know a lot of people.
Yeah.
Hence why I started the Nuclear Solution, was it gave me a chance to hire some actors, which introduced me to the community. I met Whitney Johnson that way. She's lovely. She's in my current show, Whispering. She's friends with a lot of the people I'm friends with now. It's hard to say I have any advice about how to go about starting voice acting, because so much of how I got started involved multiple steps and multiple intersections almost.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't just start because I started auditioning one day and then I got a show. And I didn't just start because I just wrote my own show one day and published it. And I also didn't just start because I met somebody who put me on their show. It was kind of all of these things happening concurrently. That led me to where I am now. Yeah. So I would just say, be bold. That's my biggest piece of advice, especially coming from the position of a director recently. I cannot tell you how many times I cried out of boredom listening to the 50th take that day that sounded exactly like the other ones. And that's advice for any actor, really, is you make a decision and you stick with it. And you make a hard decision. You don't just pitter-patter through what you're reading. Read whatever sides you're auditioning with before you sit down at the mic and actually practice them away from the mic. I got a lot of auditions for Whispering that sounded like they sat down in front of the mic, opened up the sides, read it for the first time out loud, closed the computer, and hit send.
Yeah.
And it was painful to listen to. So yeah, just be bold, shoot your shot. I got a bit part for the Haunted Hour podcast by doing that. Josh got the part in Caravan by doing that. Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Fortune favors the bold, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Now I cannot tell you the there have been like this podcast has been like an exceptionally like way to go ahead and reimagine like, oh, I'm just like how how bold I can be. From the amount of people I try to go ahead and like get in for interviews or all that, like people who I've known and I've like admired for a while, especially like way back, and I finally, my first chance to like go ahead and contact them is like, hey, sit and talk with me for an hour. Like, that is one of the hardest like things to go ahead and sell some people. But it's worked. I've gotten you. I mean, like, that's I've gotten a number of different like people who I've known for a while, like personally, just from the fact that one, I asked, two, I brought them value from what I've done, and three, I was willing to go ahead and like I was able to go ahead and recognize that like, no matter what happens, like, this sort of thing needs to be, things need to be sort of understood, especially from, like, a auditioning standpoint. The work that you put forward and push forward the most is, like, what you need to, like, focus on the most. If you work in voice acting, you need to recognize that your auditions are everything. Having it be a little bit weird or a little bit like out there or a little more like further is like something people can recognize, especially if there's a lot of different like things. If there's a lot of different auditions for it, being something that is like, what does this character sound like? No, you shouldn't think about it exactly like that. You should think about like, what does this character sound like to me? Yeah, yes. There's a lot of different things you need to go ahead and recognize with that, because like, there's some things you can go ahead and just say, like, if you were to go ahead and be like, oh, this is probably what the director thinks would be.
Try to read the director's mind, because you don't know them. And mm-hmm. also, if the instructions say send, you know, 2 to 3 takes, have your first take be the normal take. Whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. I asked for two takes, I think, from everybody. A couple people only sent me one. That was fine. They were good takes.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that stood out to me were the people that sent me a normal take. You know, now I've learned what they sound like. Now I know what their normal range is. And then whose second take was wild ass shit.
Mm-hmm.
Can I curse on this podcast?
Don't worry, I've got I've had to censor everybody. Don't you worry about it.
it was some wild butt crap.
No, you're fine. They already heard the first one. You're fine.
And it was so great. And that's the stuff I remember. And that's the stuff that makes me want to cast them, because it tells me that they're gonna be willing to do stuff that I tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's weird, and I've asked for some weird stuff, and they're going to be willing to interpret scenes in different ways, and they might even be willing to improvise. And I'm terrible at improvisation, so I mm-hmm. say that with a lot of respect, because mm-hmm. it's hard.
Yeah.
Improvising is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I look for in my actors. I don't necessarily look for who's the best actor. I look for actors that are going to be flexible. And that's not the same with every show, you know. I take a really hands-on approach with my shows because I want to focus on it from a directing standpoint. I want to work with my actors to get the best quality from them so I don't have to ask them to do a bunch of retakes.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, they do focus on the show more from the sound standpoint. They're thinking a lot about the sound design, the environmental design, you know, piecing that part together. And that's fine. And that's an amazing way to go about it, because I don't have the vocabulary to talk about sound design that much and to think about it that much.
Mm-hmm.
But you really want to show off that you have range. And I think that's the biggest part. And that's such a heavy word for voice actors to hear, for any actor to hear, is range.
Yeah.
Because what does range mean?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have the answer to that. I can't tell you what range means. Range is different for every actor. And I think that's also another piece of advice, is being able to figure out what your niche is.
Yeah.
And that'll tell you what your range is.
Mm.
So when you're auditioning for roles, especially on the voice acting standpoint, because you only have audio cues, you don't have visual cues like you do with stage acting, that can help inform who your character is. You have only audio, so your character needs to be identifiable from the moment you open your mouth. And that's why you gotta figure out what your niche is. For my partner, Josh Rubino, he's a villain. But he's not just a villain. He's the buttoned-up, ascot-wearing, monocle, top-hat, tails kind of villain.
Yeah.
He's a very put-together kind of villain, and so a lot of the voices that he cultivates are based around that niche. When he auditions, he gives 2 to 3 takes, a couple different voices, showcasing a full range within his niche, within the, you know, super-duper Bond villain and normal guy. Range. My range is more of a chaotic villainry, so I've got cackles, I've got smokers' coughs, I've got weird gremlin voices, and my takes are usually somewhere along that line, somewhere between normal and Entrapta from She-Ra and, like, straight-up Gollum from Lord of the Rings. That's what range looks like to me.
Yeah.
And every voice actor needs to figure out what range looks like to them by figuring out what niche they feel most comfortable in. So when you're auditioning for a show, they're asking for multiple takes. They want to see your range. They want to see your niche. And they want to see how bold you can be about it.
I definitely think those are some wonderful, actionable advice that you've definitely given to people. And I know you said, like, oh, I don't know if, like, no, yeah, you definitely, like, that is going to help out a lot of, that's going to help out a lot of people to recognize, like, oh, that's what they mean when they say, like, range. Like, every single different take should not be the way you pronounce a different way to pronounce each word. It should be a wide variety of what you have to say. But
it took me a while to come to that, too. I've made a ton of mistakes with auditions and range, so I'm speaking to you from pained experience.
Of course, of course. We all have. What is a human being but a pile of pained experiences brought to the present? Anyway, oh man, that sounds awful. But I was gonna go ahead and ask about if you want to talk a bit about your early life, but I just said that anyway.
Oh, okay. Speaking of pained experiences, piled up. In human form.
Let's talk
about my early life.
No, you can go ahead and I'd love to go ahead and wrap things up with getting people they've of course heard a lot about you from the tales that you fireside folk tales and the voice acting work that you have done, and the idea of, like, you want to go ahead and bring joy through the soap opera and the work that you've done in Shire Suds. But to wrap yourself up in a neat little bow, this is gonna be the most corny shit I've ever said. Who is Dallas Wheatley?
Dallas Wheatley. Dallas Wheatley is sunshine personified, as one person so eloquently put it one day. I think it's still the best compliment I've ever gotten. But it's an honor I hold very dearly to be sunshine personified. Not to say I don't have my bad days. I'm riddled with a slew of mental illnesses. But I'm pretty vocal about how hard life can get. I don't shy away from being honest about who I am. I don't shy away from shining the brightest I possibly can, even if it gives you sunburn. And you can get sunburned by following me on Twitter.
Yes.
Podcasts.
Yes. You can follow Dallas everywhere on Sweet Podcast. That is SWHEAT Podcasts. You can follow Fireside Folk Tales at FireSide_Folk on Twitter. You can take a look at Shire Suds at Shire Suds, SHIRESUDS. You can go ahead and I gotta keep going through everything. The Soap Opera Pod. You can go ahead and follow the Soap Opera Pod at The Soap Opera Pod.
It's simple enough. So many accounts.
You have different things for each one.
I'm gonna get off social media, and then I just downloaded TikTok today. Ugh. So, like, I'm really not doing myself any favors.
There is, it's totally fine. You being out there is the perfect way for everybody to go ahead and follow you and find you.
Yes.
And recognize that you are a wonderful creator in the voice acting, the audio drama, and the podcasting space that is a voice that needs to be heard because everyone needs a little bit more sunshine in their life.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go ahead and wrap it up from here. Thank you so much, Dallas.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Commissions Open. If you would, please follow this podcast with whatever app you use. I would most definitely appreciate it. I would like to give a huge thank you to all the wonderful artists and guests who I've had on in the past. In terms of artists, we've had at Doida Flower, at DoiDuhFlower, the artist behind the visuals on YouTube and other social media sites, as well as the various characters for myself and for each guest. I'd like to give a huge thank you to at Meloscav, at MeloScav, who created the icon for this podcast. And I'd like to give a huge thank you to at Andromeda_Snow, who is the one who's made all the promotional art for this podcast. Finally, I'd love to give a huge thank you to Dallas Wheatley, who did this amazing interview with me. You can follow them at Sweet Podcasts, spelled SWHEAT Podcasts on Twitter. I think that just about wraps everything up, so I just want to go ahead and say thank you, and have a wonderful day.